This recording is copyright by Robert Nicholson and Simone Braverman. All rights reserved. IELTS Listening Practice Tests. Test 12. In the IELTS test, you hear some recordings and you have to answer questions on them. You have time to read the instructions and questions and check your work. All recordings are played only once. The test is in four parts. Now turn to Part 1. Part 1. You will hear a conversation between a man and a woman as they discuss a hiking holiday in Scotland. First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 5. Now we begin. You should answer the questions as you listen, as the recording is not played twice. Listen carefully to the conversation and answer questions 1 to 5.
So, Sophie, are you ready to talk about a holiday in Scotland?
Oh, yes. I'm looking forward to getting things finalised.
So, we start a holiday in Oban, then we go to Skye and after that to Lewis.
That's right.
Now, we're staying in Oban for 5 nights from the 8th of July until the 13th. Is that right?
I thought we were one day earlier. Let's have a look. No, you're right. It's from the 8th. It's my grandmother's birthday on the 7th and I got mixed up.
Good, that's settled then. It wouldn't have been a good start if we got the dates wrong.
No, I remember that I wanted to be at home for Grandma's birthday and that we could leave the next day.
So the next thing should be how we're going to get to Oban.
Well, as I see it, we have the choice of driving up, the train or the bus.
Yes, driving up wouldn't be the cheapest, but it would be the fastest. However, as we're going on a hiking holiday, we won't need the car at all after we've arrived.
And as we're taking the ferry to Lewis, it'll be cheaper not to have the car and to travel as foot passengers.
The bus would be convenient then, as it takes us straight to Oban with only one change.
The train does as well.
That's true. Though I checked, and if we book the bus in advance, the train will be twice as expensive.
Well, let's go for the cheapest option then. The bus won't be that much longer. Are you okay with that?
Yes, that's fine. We can use the money we save on spoiling ourselves when we're there.
So, what's next?
We have to decide on where we're going to stay.
Yes. Now, you know I said I'd check some places out?
Yes. You said that you would order some magazines.
Well, I had a look at some places online, but I didn't have much time and I didn't manage to do anything else.
That's okay. Don't worry. I know that you were really busy.
Yes. I had good intentions, but they didn't work out.
So, now we have to decide what kind of place we want to stay in. The choice is really a hostel, a guest house, or a hotel.
I'm tired of staying in cheap hostels, and I've had a look at the guest houses, and there's not a great selection.
I agree. So, we'll go for a hotel then.
Yes, we can use the money we saved on the travel.
Okay, now, do you want to have breakfast and dinner at the hotel?
I'd say so. It would be very convenient. Breakfast would be waiting for us every morning, and in the evenings we'd be tired after our hiking and not too keen to go out.
That's true, but Oban has great places to eat, and I think we should make the effort to get out in the evenings and try some places. Oban's small and nothing will be too far away.
Okay, I'll go along with that. I still think breakfast would be better at the hotel, though.
Yes, I agree with that.
Before the conversation continues, you have some time to look at questions 6 to 10. Now listen carefully and answer questions 6 to 10.
So, have you researched any hiking routes when we get to Oban?
Yes, I've looked at a few. My favourite one is a coastal route that goes from Oban to a small town called Dunbeg.
Tell me about it.
It's a nice, easy one to start with. This is because we stick to the coast, so there are no hills to deal with. We'd start after breakfast and head north and move up and hug the coast. The hike will take about 3.5 hours, and the end point is Dunbeg, which is inland a little.
Are there any good things to see?
Yes, there are the views of the sea and, of course, the island of Kerrera, across from Oban. Soon we'll pass St. Columba's Cathedral, and near the end of the walk there's a spectacular ruined castle next to the sea. At the end, we can get a bus back from Dunbeg.
How long does the bus take?
Only about 1/4 hour. We can walk back the way we came or walk back along the road. But I thought it would be nice to have lunch in Dunbeg and then get back to Oban quickly and spend the afternoon looking around the town.
That all sounds fine. Have you found any other hikes?
You know, I mentioned the island of Kerrera earlier.
Yes.
Well, for the second day's hike, we can get a ferry across to the island from Oban, and there are a number of routes there. The easiest and most popular route is the southern one, and again, we'll get to see a castle.
Is it a demanding route?
Not at all. The hike is approximately 5 miles in total, and I think it will take us at least 3 hours for it. The island is mostly flat, and the path is well tended. It shouldn't stretch us very much.
I expect there'll be a lot of sea views again, being an island. I really like that.
Actually, not as much as you'd think, as we'll be going inland a lot.
We'll have seen a lot of the sea the day before, so that's fine.
That's what I thought.
Good. I'll be quite unfit and I want to break into things slowly. We can go for harder hikes later in the holiday.
Exactly. So to make this hike into a day trip, we can look around the castle as it was restored a few years ago. We can also take a picnic and relax next to a good view.
Well, that's the first 2 days then. Now, the first hike should be easy to find our way as we're just following the coastline. But the second could be harder if we're going inland.
Yes, I thought about that. I went onto the island's website and we can buy a map on the ferry while we're crossing over.
Oh, good. Well done. You seem to have done some good research.
Thanks. I'm quite excited about our trip.
That is the end of part one. You will now have 1/2 minute to check your answers. Now turn to part two. Part two. You will hear a woman telling a group information about a museum tour. First, you have some time to look at questions 11 to 15. Now listen carefully to the information talk and answer questions 11 to 15.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this tour of the Wayport Museum. My name is Victoria, and I'll be showing you round today. This will be a 2-hour tour, and I'll show you all the key exhibits that we possess. Naturally, we won't be able to look at everything, but the museum will remain open for 3 hours after the tour ends, so you'll be able to see anything you missed then. The building that the museum stands in today has been here since the late 19th century. It was built by the local Wayport Town Council and owned by them until 10 years ago, although the use of the building changed several times during their ownership. 10 years ago, the Town Council allowed the building to be bought by a group of enthusiasts that had been canvassing for a larger and better equipped town museum for quite a few years. They had gained cash from a variety of fundraising activities that were supported by the general public. The existing small museum was happy to merge with the new one and allow the new one to take all the exhibits, and the previous museum director continued in his post at the new museum. The new museum's purchase was also assisted financially by the local engineering company Ryland Limited, whose managing director is a great patron of the arts. At first, the local council wasn't too keen on letting go of the building, but the Central Arts Council in London liked the idea of the new museum and applied some administrative pressure. The local council agreed, and the sale went through fairly quickly. As I said, the history of the building was varied. It started off as an office administration centre for the local council. Unfortunately, there was a fire in 1920, and after that, the building lay unused for a number of years. There was a lack of funds for renovation, in spite of the insurance payout. From 1930, the building was made safe and used as a storage facility for old files and other records belonging to the town council. The army tried to gain control of the building to use as a recruitment centre during World War II, but the building was deemed too unsafe for the projected numbers of people. After the war, the building continued its pre-war use until the 1960s, when the council used the building for its local education department. The building remained like this until it was sold for the new museum. The education department moved to the new council offices on the edge of town and is found next to the housing department.
You now have some time to look at questions 16 to 20. Now listen to the rest of the information talk and answer questions 16 to 20.
So, we'll begin the tour on the ground floor. Right now, we're in the reception hall, where you all bought your tickets. We've just come in through the main doors with the ticket office opposite. We'll start by going in through the door on the right. If you go left, you'll find the museum's bathrooms. You'll need to come back here if you want to use them. So, in this first room on the right, we'll find our collections of paintings. We have mostly pictures by local painters. No one is particularly famous, but the quality is very high, and we get visitors from all over the country. We continue the tour into the next two rooms, where we will find very unusual exhibitions. This town is famous for its factories that manufacture clocks and silverware. The clock collection from the local factories comes first, and then the following room focuses on silverware. In the corner of the silverware room, there is a room where you can see a film that explains the history of both our town's famous industries. Moving round into the next room, we'll find displays from the town's Iron Age history. There are examples of a variety of things that have been discovered in and around the town. We have old pots, jewellery, weapons, examples of surviving architecture, and plenty of photographs of local archaeological sites. The next room houses the museum's cafe, where you can get hot or cold drinks and some snacks to eat. Finally, the last room on the ground floor holds our collection of antique children's toys. It's amazing to see the range of things that were manufactured, and this room is always a favourite with visitors. After we've finished there, we'll move up the stairs to the first floor, where we'll continue.
That is the end of part two. You will now have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to part three. Part three. You will hear three students discussing a field trip. First, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 25. Now listen carefully and answer questions 21 to 25.
Hi, Alan.
Hi, Ellie. Hi, Janet. How are you both today?
Hi, Alan. We're both good. Are you ready to discuss our field trip?
Sure. That's why I'm here.
Good. Let's get started. We're going to go on a trip down the coast to look at cliff formations. We know the date we're going, so the first thing is that we need to decide how to get there.
Yes, the options are hiring a car for the day or getting the bus. Car will be more flexible, but the bus will be cheaper.
I'll go down to the bus station this afternoon and check prices and times, and then I'll go to that local car hire company next to the supermarket and get a quote.
Good. Now, we have the general area where we want to go, but we need to narrow down our survey area exactly.
I've had a look at the map. The best area would be from Durham Rocks to Long Beach.
Why there?
First of all, there's a car park and bus stop next to the Durham Rocks, and there are also paths at the top of the cliff and at its foot at low tide along the beach. We'll get good access for our survey.
Well done, Alan. How long do you think the survey will take?
I reckon about 5 hours to do a good job. We won't need to stay overnight like some of the other groups. That's good, as there are no hostels or anything where we're going.
What things do we need to take with us?
The usual survey stuff. Maps, compasses, a level kit and a rangefinder.
Can we get all that?
The department has it all and we can book it out as long as no one's got there first. I'll do that this afternoon when I go in for our lecture.
Thanks, Ellie.
Is there any food available where we're going? We'll be there for quite some time and if things take longer than expected, we'll get hungry.
I'll check that out online. My laptop's at home right now, but I'll need to get it before my lecture. I'll do it when I get home. If there's nowhere to eat, I'll make some sandwiches and bring some water or something. I'll let you know at the lecture.
Well, that's the organisation part done for the time being. Let's just hope it doesn't rain. I don't fancy spending 5 hours under an umbrella.
You now have some time to look at questions 26 to 30. Now listen to the rest of the discussion and answer questions 26 to 30.
So why are we going to the area of the coast anyway? There are plenty of cliffs much closer to us.
It's all to do with the erosion of the cliffs in that area. There are some really classic examples there. Do you remember that lecture we had on coastal erosion?
I missed that lecture as I was sick.
I'll explain. The cliffs in that area mostly consist of sand and clay with very little rock. This makes them very susceptible to erosion.
Do all coastlines suffer from erosion?
It depends. Both exposed and sheltered coasts can suffer from it. The coast has to receive the power of the sea in a certain direction and force. Currents, winds and tides also play a key role.
Where we're going, the sea comes right up to the cliffs at high tide. The waves can then batter the soft lower parts of the cliffs. At low tide, we can walk in front of the cliffs for our survey.
Does that make it dangerous to walk at the top of the cliffs?
It can be. Fortunately, the area where we're going has paths set well back and there are fences to keep people away from edges that might be dangerous. We won't need to go close to the edges of the cliffs anyway.
So what happens when the waves hit the lower parts of the cliffs?
It's simple, really. The cliff is worn away and an undercut is made. The deeper this becomes, the more unstable the cliff above becomes. When the weight above becomes too much, then the cliff collapses.
This, of course, can cause problems if there is anything significant on top of the cliffs.
It sounds like it's dangerous to be under the cliffs as well.
Yes, it is. The Coast Guard is responsible for keeping a close eye on the cliffs, though, and you can check on the dangerous areas on their website. There are lots of signs in dangerous areas too.
Before we go, we'd better check on that and the tides as well, as they can come in quickly.
I intend to.
Don't worry, Janet. We won't go into any danger areas.
Should we take flares in case we get into any problems?
No, I don't think that's necessary. We'll all just take our mobile phones with us. If we do run into any trouble, then we can call the authorities. It really won't be a problem, Janet. If I thought we'd be in any danger, I'd take an inflatable boat with us or not go at all.
That is the end of part 3. You will now have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to part 4. Part 4. You will hear a lecture on the Wechsler-Bellevue intelligence scale. First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 40. Now listen carefully and answer questions 31 to 40.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the psychology lecture. Today we are going to look at one of the most common tests that is used to assess intelligence. Many tests have been created for this purpose, but we are focusing this morning on the Wechsler-Bellevue Intelligence Scale. Dr. David Wechsler, a clinical psychologist at New York's Bellevue Hospital, believed that intelligence is a global construct, reflecting a variety of measurable skills and should be considered in the setting of the overall personality. Dissatisfied with the intelligence tests in vogue when he started practicing, Wechsler created intelligence scales that included many novel concepts and breakthroughs to the intelligence testing movement. He did away with the quotient scores of older intelligence tests, or the Q and IQ. Instead, he assigned an arbitrary value of 100 to the mean intelligence and added or subtracted 15 points for each standard deviation above or below the subject's mean. The theoretical basis for the Wechsler-Bellevue intelligence scale and the other Wechsler scales came from this belief of Wechsler's that intelligence is a complex ability involving a variety of skills. Because intelligence is multifaceted, Wechsler believed a test measuring intelligence must reflect this multitude of skills. Wechsler divided the concept of intelligence into two principal areas, verbal and performance, and further subdivided and tested each area with a different subtest. Wechsler's full-scale test is broken down into 14 subtests, comprising the verbal scale, 7 verbal subtests, the performance scale, and 7 performance subtests. Wechsler's tests provide 3 scores: a verbal IQ score, a performance IQ score, and a composite IQ score based on the combined scores. Verbal subtests aim to test general cultural information, abstract comprehension, arithmetic, verbal reasoning, vocabulary, concentration, and memory. Performance subtests include visual perception, visual motor coordination, spatial perception, abstract problem solving, sequential reasoning, perception speed, and visual analysis. These conceptualizations continue to be reflected in the Wechsler scales of the 21st century, and the Wechsler-Bellevue intelligence scale continues to remain the most commonly administered psychological test in existence. The Wechsler adult intelligence scale is appropriate throughout adulthood. For testing children aged 7 to 16, the Wechsler intelligence scale for children is used, while The Wechsler Preschool and Primary Scale of Intelligence is used for testing children aged 2.5 to 7. Both tests can be completed without a literacy requirement in their subjects. Although the Wechsler-Bellevue Intelligence Scale is regarded as extremely useful and accurate, it does have some limitations. As long as test administrators realize this, the test can be used very reliably for its design purposes. The limitations are not serious. It is not considered for measuring extremes of intelligence, which are indicated by IQ scores below 40 and above 160. Wechsler himself was even more conservative, stressing that his scales were not appropriate for people with an IQ below 70 or above 130. Also, when administering the Wechsler Adult Intelligence Scale to people at extreme ends of the age range, such as below 20 years of age or above 70, caution should be used for the interpretation of scores. Besides being used as an intelligence assessment, one other use of the Wechsler-Bellevue Intelligence Scale is that it can be used for neuropsychological evaluation, as large differences in answers testing verbal and nonverbal intelligence may be a sign of specific sorts of brain damage. Intelligence scores reported by the Wechsler-Bellevue Intelligence Scale can also be used as part of the diagnostic criteria for learning disabilities and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. However, the consensus of professionals in the field is that the Wechsler-Bellevue Intelligence Scale is best used as a tool to evaluate intelligence and not to diagnose ADHD or learning disabled children. Nevertheless, many clinicians use it to compare a child's cognitive development to his or her actual social or school capabilities. Using discrepancies in the scale and other sources of data, the Wechsler-Bellevue Intelligence Scale can contribute information concerning a child's psychological well-being. So, to conclude the first part of this lecture, the Wechsler-Bellevue Intelligence Scale is regularly used by researchers in many areas of psychology as a measure of intelligence, and it is considered to be a valid and reliable measure of general intelligence. It is so well regarded that other intelligence tests are often compared to it when undergoing reliability and validity studies.
That is the end of part 4. You will now have half a minute to check your answers. That is the end of listening test 12.